KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Wind can be a very significant power provider in the United States, especially in the Midwest. Environmental lawyer and writer Philip Warburg talks about wind as a resource, including how it relates to the economy and climate change. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 4th, 2012. The talk was introduced by Dennis Hayes. He is the CEO of the Bullitt Foundation and coordinator of the First Earth Day.
So about 35 years ago, I got a call one day from a fellow named Jeremy Stone. And he said, Dennis, I've got a guy here I really want you to meet. He's an environmentalist, but he's one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I've been sort of processing this, he's an environmentalist, but he's smart, comment. And from Jeremy, that was really something of a compliment, a fairly high bar. For those of you of a certain age, he was I.F. Stone's son, so he spent his youth at dinner with the leading leftist intellectuals of the Western Hemisphere. And he was then the executive director of something called the Federation of American Scientists that had 90% of the Nobel Prize winners from the United States on its advisory board. So my expectations in coming over to meet Phil Warburg were relatively high. And I walked into the room, and there's this guy sitting there. It looks like he's about 12 years old. It was disconcerting, but we got into a conversation, and in fact, he presented a wealth of knowledge, presented sort of humbly, and then talked strategically about a series of things that were really important to me. He was then working for Senator Percy on energy policy. I had just taken a role in the Carter administration in energy policy. And he was, those were the days when we had Republicans like John Lindsay, Bill Ruckelshaus, Dan Evans, Chuck Percy. I mean, they were very, very different from the kinds of polarized politics that we have today. And with guidance from Phil, Percy emerged as, on either side of the aisle, one of the true energy leaders. Among other things, he founded the Alliance to Save Energy, which is still arguably dominantly the top lobbying group on industrial and commercial energy savings in the country. And sort of from that beginning of kind of being awed by somebody who I was already at the age that I was clearly capable of having been his father, This guy's career sort of bounced around in a myriad of directions. He went on to get his law degree from Harvard, which is the first indication that maybe he wasn't quite as smart as Jeremy thought he was. Went off to become a war correspondent in the Middle East. Ran the largest environmental organization in Israel. Did a number of projects in Jordan and in Gaza. Was deeply involved in human rights issues. And after things got particularly hairy over there, came back and took on the difficult job of running the Conservation Law Foundation in New England, which is among regional environmental groups in the United States the premier organization. It's the one that other regions, we really don't have anything quite like it here. We have the Northwest Energy Coalition, which does on energy regionally what CLF does on energy and toxics and wilderness and roads and what have you. Just a super group, ran that for many years, got deeply involved in the Cape Wind Project, which everybody here mostly thinks of in terms of the hypocrisy of the Kennedy family, but it was another one of these deep things. He's been involved in nuclear issues. It's how he cut his teeth on energy. And in issue after issue after issue, war and peace, human rights, the environment, sustainability, clean energy, Phil has brought that same incisive intellect that he displayed that very first meeting 35 years ago. So when I found out that he was writing a book on wind, I told him I'd love to do anything that I could to promote it because I knew it would have a message that would be beautifully crafted and persuasive. And he's now completed the book. He's here and delighted to introduce him to you. Phil Warburg.
Thank you, Dennis. That was wonderful. It's touching to be here and addressing an issue that both of us care so deeply about. Dennis is really one of my all-time environmental heroes, going back to Earth Day 1970 before I was 12 years old. I was actually 15 years old before I was 12 years old. But In 1970, I was 15 and very distressed about what seemed to be the kind of blind rush toward development without any attention given to the environment that had prevailed since World War II. And then came Earth Day, and all of a sudden, 20 million people around the country were talking about how we could begin to address all of these environmental woes that we had been sweeping under the rug for so long. And Dennis really set the tone for the nation in bringing that debate to the fore. We have him to thank for that. And his work ongoing since then has been very impressive, heading up the first national energy laboratory focusing solely on renewable energy, first called the Solar Energy Research Institute, now the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. And I'll come back to that as I talk about the issue I want to talk about tonight. Just this afternoon, Dennis took me to see the Bullitt Center's new building, which is absolutely staggering, and I'm sure many of you have seen it. It's not yet ready for prime time, but it is an absolutely cutting-edge new building that will set an example not just for Seattle but for the nation. I also want to thank the Northwest Energy Coalition for encouraging me to come to Seattle and for promoting this event among its members. Lila Stees is somewhere in this blackness that I can't see, so thank you, Lila, for all of your efforts. I want to talk about wind power tonight as a way to address three of the most critical issues that we face in America today. One of them is our lagging economy. Wind power is a gateway to lots of American jobs, and I'll come back to describe some of those jobs as we move through this discussion. But they're well-paying jobs, and they're often jobs in remote areas where employment is especially hard to come by. The second issue is energy independence. We get 45% of our oil today from foreign sources. The good news is that's down from 60%, which was the percentage in 2005. The bad news is that's still a staggering dependence upon a foreign energy resource, and wind power can help us move away from that dependence upon foreign energy resources, and I'll talk a little bit about how that's the case. And the third issue that wind power helps us address is climate change. I think of climate change as the Lord Voldemort of environmental issues in Washington. It's the issue that can't be named because the fossil and nuclear fuel lobby is so powerful in scaring congresspeople away from even beginning to talk about climate change and what we might do about it on a national level. But it's an issue that we can't afford to ignore. Global temperatures are rising, sea levels are rising, oceans are acidifying, storm activity is increasing and intensifying. I'm not sure what it will take to wake up the nation, and more particularly our nation's ostensible leaders, to how important and how crucial this issue is to address. Wind power can help us begin to move in the right direction on that issue as well.
Philip Warburg, the author of Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 4th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Philip Warburg in a moment. 8:15, 94.9 KUOW. The Canadian military has stepped in after the Coast Guard called off the search for five missing Nova Scotia fishermen. Also, the lead detective in the murder case against Olympic sprinter Oscar Pistorius is himself facing attempted murder charges. Someone detonated multiple bombs in one of the busiest parts of the southern Indian city of Hyderabad. And turns out beavers inadvertently lend a hand to Canada geese looking for spring nests. Details on all these items tonight at 11. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows near 40, breezy, rain likely this evening, rain at times after midnight. For Friday, the prediction is for highs of around 50 degrees, windiness, and raininess.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Wind was once feared in the Midwest. During the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, it destroyed farmland and left thousands homeless. Today, wind has the capacity for good when it comes to power generation. Philip Warburg is an environmental lawyer and the author of Harvest the Wind: America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 4th, 2012.
So, how big a role can we expect wind power to play as we move toward the future? Well, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the successor to the Solar Energy Research Institute, produced this map showing the different levels of wind that are available across the nation. And as you can see from the purple area stretching down from the Dakotas in the north on through Texas in the south, that is our area of greatest wind resources. However, we have superabundant wind resources across much of the nation, so much so that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory estimates we could be getting 10 times our current total power needs from wind, from land-based sources alone, and from abundant wind areas alone. If you throw offshore wind resources into the mix, that multiplier goes up to about 14 times our current power supply. I have to be careful when I throw out those numbers. In Chicago, I made a similar statement, and I was quoted, as you can see, saying, author Philip Warburg says, America can increase electric power 10 times with wind. Needless to say, as an environmentalist, my goal in life is not to get America to increase its total power use by 10 times or, in fact, at all. But it's to say that we can really turn to wind as a very significant power provider, much more so than we are today, even though we're making a good start today. So what can we expect? I've talked about what the overall potential is, but what can we expect in the next few decades if we were really to commit ourselves to developing wind power as a resource? The Department of Energy, under George Bush, interestingly, in 2008, came out with a study called Wind Powering America, 20% by 2030. And that study, as its title suggests, charts out a course to get us to be a fifth reliant upon wind for our power needs by 2030, within two decades. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, more recently, has come out with a renewable electricity futures study, and that study projects that wind and solar alone, using technology that is commercially available today, could be providing half of our total power needs by the middle of this century. So we're not talking about some exotic hypothetical energy resource that we could tap someday. We're talking about a resource that is at hand and that could really be making a huge dent in our fossil fuel emissions and our reliance upon nuclear energy. Our use of wind power is by no means new. Going back to colonial times, we used the wind to saw wood, to grind grain, to pump water. And in fact, water pumping windmills like this one were used to open up vast stretches of farmland and ranch land across the Midwest and the West in the late 19th century. Hundreds of thousands of these were used at that time. And we often think about the railroads as opening up the West, which is in part true, but I think we underrate the very, very important role that wind power, in fact, played in opening up the West. We've also used wind power for quite some time to generate electricity, not abundant amounts of electricity. This is called a wind charger, and it was used quite widely on farmsteads across the country in the 20s, 30s, and even into the 40s a bit, in areas that had not yet been reached by rural electrification. As you can tell by the design and by the 12-volt battery at the bottom, we're not exactly talking about a huge power supply, but it was enough to get a trickle of electricity into these households, to light some light bulbs, and perhaps more significantly, to open up the radio airwaves to farmers and ranchers who until that point had been isolated from that 20th century communications medium. The anecdotal use of wind power to keep a few farmsteads lit and connected to the world was obviously no match for the very large-scale wind projects that developed in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s in the United States. Hydro dams like the Hoover Dam, I actually just visited the Hoover Dam for the first time last week, huge coal plants, oil plants, and the like, generating lots of electricity, seemingly without grave side effects. We've only come more recently to realize just how misguided our over-reliance on those technologies are. I'm not talking about hydro. I'm talking about the coal and the oil. And in fact, what happened in the 1950s was in many ways more disturbing, and that was we had a technology that was a war technology that utterly devastated Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and there was a feverish attempt to come up with some way to create uses for the peaceful atom. So we began to generate nuclear power, vastly subsidized by the federal government through research and development and through a liability cap on nuclear accidents, that without which nuclear power would never have gone anywhere. And all of this really pushed renewable energy to the side until the 1970s. Two events really happened, or two phenomena really happened during the 1970s. The first, which we've talked about a little bit, was Earth Day 1970s. You may recognize the person in this photograph. He's in this room. The growth in environmental awareness and the sense that, well, there might not be the free lunch that we thought there was in terms of burning fossil fuels and relying upon nuclear power. And then the second major event was the Arab oil embargo of 1973. And at that point, with gas lines stretching around blocks and people becoming quite alarmed at the first experience in their lifetimes, most of them, unless they lived through World War II, of energy shortage, people began to say, well, you know, we better really try to figure out what to do about this. And it was actually Richard Nixon who, in 1974, in the waning days of his presidency, proclaimed a new initiative called Project Independence. Now, this Project Independence was targeted at making America 100% independent of foreign energy resources by 1980. Needless to say, that target was far from met. And he was really talking about developing coal in the West, opening up federal lands for drilling oil and gas. That might sound like a recent Republican candidate for the presidency, and expediting nuclear power plant licensing. Solar was mentioned very briefly and as a distant prospect, and wind wasn't mentioned at all. But at least Nixon was waking up to the challenge of how do we move toward a more energy-independent America. It was really Jimmy Carter who was the first president to put renewable energy squarely on the national political agenda. Very early in his term, he called for an energy plan that would get us to 20% reliance on renewable energy by the year 2000. Needless to say, we didn't meet that target, but Carter was earnest in, no one would accuse Carter of being anything but earnest. He was earnest in trying to lay out a plan that just might get us there. And that plan included new laws that provided a way for independent power producers, including producers of electricity from wind and solar and other renewable resources, to sell their power to electric utilities for the first time. He also vastly expanded the renewable energy research and development budget, created the Solar Energy Research Institute, and promoted federal tax incentives for wind energy, solar energy, and other renewable energy developers. Symbolically but importantly, he installed solar panels on the roof of the White House as a gesture in the right direction. Jimmy Carter's aspirations were more impressive than his mode of delivery. I can tell that at least some people recognize this sweater. In February of 1977, just a month after being elected, he delivered what has now become known as the sweater speech. He sat beside a roaring fireplace in the White House wearing this sweater and counseled America on how we could move to a brighter, happier energy future. Unfortunately, his recipe was not exactly a winning one. He proposed that we all turn our thermostats down to 65 degrees during the daytime and a bone-chilling 55 degrees at night. Needless to say, this didn't go over terribly well. But it showed his seriousness in helping Americans begin to think about how we could achieve a level of comfort without relying upon the fossil fuels that we had been so accustomed to relying upon for so long. Then came Ronald Reagan. When he rode into town in 1981, he lacerated Carter for promoting what he called the sharing of austerity. He blamed him for our disintegrating economy. And he really returned America to a approach to energy development, which we've come to associate with Sarah Palin, a kind of drill, baby drill mentality. And he pushed for the expedited extraction of gas and oil and coal. He was an ardent proponent of nuclear energy. And in a kind of negative, cynical, symbolic gesture, he stripped the panels off of the White House roof. He also dismantled the energy incentives that made it possible for wind energy, solar energy, and other renewable technologies to begin to compete with fossil and nuclear fuels. So predictably, by the mid-1980s, the wind movement went from boom to bust. There was another significant factor there, and that was the deregulation of natural gas. But Ronald Reagan really set a very negative tone, and he backed that tone by stripping away research and development funding for renewable energy. Dennis can tell you a lot about that. Really moved us away from the kind of future that Jimmy Carter hoped we would be moving toward. Thankfully, wind power is back on track today. During the first 4 years of the Obama administration, we doubled our reliance upon wind power. I'd like to get a sense, I can't point to people raising hands, but does anyone want to shout out what you think our current reliance upon wind power amounts to? What's the percentage of our total power supply that we now get from wind?
6%.
Good. That's all in the right range. We get about 4% of our total power needs from wind today, and that's enough to provide the power needs for about 13 million American households. Some states, however, are way ahead of that curve. South Dakota gets 22% of its power from wind. Iowa generates about 20% of its power from wind. Even Texas, which we think of as the big oil state, and which, by the way, is the largest power consumer in the country, despite not having the largest population, gets about 7% of its power from wind. That is actually a staggering number to consider when you're thinking about this technology, is one that until a few years ago we really hadn't heard very much about. We have a long way to go, but we're definitely heading in the right direction. Beyond generating a lot of power, a lot more could come, but a lot of power, wind power also creates jobs, and it creates jobs in the manufacturing sector, for example. About 75,000 people are right now employed by the wind industry, directly or indirectly. Many of those are in the manufacturing sector. And what has happened in the manufacturing sector is actually quite interesting. We've all been reading in the press lots of coverage of how the Chinese are eating our renewable energy lunch in the manufacture of renewable energy technology. And that, in fact, is not really the case with regard to wind. China is the largest producer of wind technology, but almost all of that technology is still used in China. That's not true of its solar technology. 95% of the panels that are produced in China are exported from China. But wind turbines are a different story. The average wind turbine that is put up on American soil today, about two-thirds of its value is American-made. And that percentage has gone up very significantly from 5 years ago, when about a third of the value of that turbine was American-made. So we're definitely heading in the right direction. But beyond generating jobs in the manufacturing sector, and I should mention, by the way, that our overall expectation for job creation by wind power, if we were to follow the 2008 plan put out by the Department of Energy, would get us beyond 250,000 jobs in the wind energy sector as we approach that 2030 goal of producing a fifth of our power from wind by that date. But jobs in the manufacturing sector, jobs in construction of wind farms, and jobs in the operation and maintenance of wind farms. Again, I can't see you, but what is the tallest ladder any of you have climbed?
20 feet.
20 feet. Okay. So wind technicians, on a daily basis, and sometimes three or four times a day, have to climb a 270-foot ladder to get to the mechanical operations room of a typical wind turbine. Some turbines today have small elevators, but a lot of them still do not. So it takes a robust physique and, frankly, also someone who's not averse to enclosed spaces. I actually tried to climb a wind turbine, and I do not love enclosed spaces, and I wouldn't exactly describe myself as robust. I made it to about 70 feet and then decided I'd probably had enough. And I was taken to this wind turbine by a two-time Iraqi veteran, and I was a little afraid of the dressing down I was going to get when I came down from my failed climb. He was actually quite kind to me, and I related to him what my two daughters said to me when they heard I was planning on climbing a wind turbine. One of them said, "Well, of course you have to try to do it. You're writing a book about wind." And the other, who's a kind of kind, gentle type, said, "You've got to be out of your mind. You shouldn't do that." They were both right in a way.
Philip Warburg, the author of Harvest the Wind: America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 4th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Philip Warburg in a moment. 835 949 KUOW. Government agencies and private companies foresee many good reasons to use unmanned remote controlled aircraft or drones in the skies over America. But some say adequate safeguards need to be established. A conversation about the matter tonight at midnight. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows near 40, breezy, rain likely this evening, rain at times after midnight. For Friday, it's highs around 50, windy, and rain. A report on a new play, a musical about women rockers of the 1990s in Seattle. It's called These Streets, and it opens tomorrow night at ACT Theater. Also, former Washington, D.C. Public Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee talks about her aggressive and controversial approach to education reform, as she writes about in her book, Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. And a conversation about sexual orientation conversion therapy in light of a new House bill that would establish a panel to investigate the effects of such therapy on minors in Washington State. All these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Philip Warburg is an environmental lawyer and the author of Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. He spoke about wind power at Seattle's Town Hall on December 4th, 2012.
I want to say a few words about my book, Harvest the Wind. Its subtitle, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability, is the big picture story. But there's another journey that this book really involved, and it was a personal journey that I took far from my native New England. And as Dennis alluded to, the Cape Wind offshore wind farm was a major challenge for me when I headed up the Conservation Law Foundation. New Englanders like to think of ourselves as a light unto the nation, so to speak, you know, environmentally progressive and moving ahead of the curve. And it frankly shocked me how much resistance there was to the Cape Wind offshore wind farm. Now, this is a wind farm whose closest landfall is about 5 miles from the outermost turbine. And that would mean that if you were to hold your arm at full arm's length, the nearest turbine would be about the size of your thumbnail. So we're not exactly talking about something that is in your face. Yet that was too much of a visual insult for many well-heeled New England vacationers, including, sadly, Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy, who was really a leader of pushing for the right kinds of energy policies over several decades. But when it came to the thought of looking at an offshore wind farm from the Hyannisport family compound, some other set of values kicked into play, and he was very determined to stop this wind farm and actually worked behind closed doors in Congress as well as being public in his opposition to this wind farm. It was really my frustration and embarrassment, frankly, with our inability to move wind power forward on a scale that could make a difference in New England that sent me to far-flung corners of the nation. Not red states by any stretch of the imagination. We're talking solid blue. The reverse. it's kind of counterintuitive, but yeah. The red states. And Cloud County, Kansas was one of my first stops. Cloud County, Kansas is located about 140 miles north of Salina. It is a very remote county. It was settled in the late 1800s when the Kansas Pacific Railroad rolled through. Its population peaked around 1910, and it's been in decline ever since. So much so that one local commentator observed, "It used to be that you could commit suicide by laying down in the middle of Main Street on a Saturday. The problem was you wouldn't die until Monday because there were so few cars." The person who made that comment was Kirk Lowell, and he is the head of the Cloud County Economic Development Agency, otherwise known as Cloud Corp. And Kirk is an avid wind booster because he sees the jobs that it brings to Cloud County, because he sees the economic development that it brings. He does not talk about climate change. Climate change is, again, that taboo subject. He does talk about energy independence. He's seen many Kansans go off to fight wars in the Middle East that he sees as being fought at least substantially over our superdependence upon foreign energy resources, and he wants to see that decline. He, again, doesn't mince words in how he phrases things. What he said to me was, either we'll have to put wind turbines on our Kansas prairie, or we'll have to continue burying our fine young men and women under it. The Meridian Way Wind Farm went into operation in December of 2008, and it has 67 turbines. Those 67 turbines generate enough electricity for 55,000 Kansas and Missouri households. About 300 jobs were created during the construction of this wind farm, many of them local, and dozens of jobs are involved in the ongoing operation and maintenance of the wind farm. So it's a great economic boon to the area in terms of jobs. But perhaps the most remarkable thing that happened in Cloud County took place at Cloud County Community College. Cloud County Community College in 2007 made a strategic bet on wind. It created a wind technology training program, and it appointed this man, Bruce Graham, a former high school science teacher, to head up the program. At the time, there were about 5 students who were interested in the program, so the college administrators leased out a little bit of classroom space sandwiched between a pawn shop and a Chinese restaurant in the local shopping mall, and they set Bruce on his way. Well, today, there are over 100 students enrolled in this program, and as you can see from this photograph, they're not all fresh scrub kids fresh off the farm. They're former Army careerists, they're school teachers, their office administrators, their refugees from the construction trades, all eager to get in on the ground floor of an exciting technology that they see as really paving our way to the 21st century. But it's not just the jobs and the job training that have resulted from the Meridian Way Wind Farm and Cloud County's commitment to wind. The farmers and the ranchers are also very significant beneficiaries. People like Kurt Kaur and his mother, Helen. I like to consider this photograph my tribute to Grant Wood's American Gothic. The Kaurs have been farming and ranching in Cloud County since the 1880s, and they get tens of thousands of dollars in annual lease payments from the wind developer. There are dozens of other families like them in Cloud County, and it's a great hedge, in their view, against the ups and downs in cattle and grain prices and the uncertainties of Midwestern weather. You know, we've all read about and perhaps experienced the horrible drought of this past summer. The wind farm continues to generate power and continues to pay those lease payments to farmers and ranchers like the Kaurs. Kurt has 2 sons who are now in college, and he's very hopeful that at least one of them will come back to run the family farm, and he feels that the guaranteed annuity that the wind farm developer pays over the next 25 years and maybe beyond that will be a major draw to bring perhaps one, perhaps 2 of his sons back to the farm. I don't want to paint an unqualifiedly rosy picture of how wind power is received, even in a place like Kansas. I went to another part of the state called the Flint Hills. The Flint Hills is a stretch of tall grass prairie covering about 11,000 square miles. It's a very large area. It's the last large remaining stretch of untrammeled tall grass prairie. And there are cowmen and cowwomen who live in the Flint Hills who are dead set against seeing vertical wind towers imposed upon their very horizontal horizon. One of those opponents, and really one of the ringleaders, is a woman named Rose Bacon. Rose actually grew up in Iowa, but she came to the Flint Hills when she was 11 years old with her father to buy cattle, and she fell in love with the place. Took a long time to get back there, but 20 years ago bought a farm and a ranch in the Flint Hills, and together with her husband Kent, a Vietnam War veteran, set up a cattle operation. I should mention that Kent has a prosthetic leg that is especially bowed so that he can actually sit on a horse and herd cattle. They're devoted to the ranching tradition, and they are adamant opponents of wind power. Rose puts it in pretty unsparing terms when she talks about wind power. She calls it a rape of the landscape. Somewhat more temperate in his description of wind farms is Bill Browning. Bill Browning is the guy in the white t-shirt on the left, and he is a physician as well as a multi-generational rancher. And here's how he describes what he thinks wind power would do to the Flint Hills. The beauty of the Flint Hills for me is where the hills meet the sky morning and evening, and the shadows come across the hills and make all the contours stand out. If you're going to put a string of 400-foot steel behemoths across the horizon, it's gone. The loneliness, the emptiness, the absence of the intrusions of people, all that would be lost. Rose and Bill and the people who are working with them to oppose wind power in the Flint Hills will never forgive Pete Farrell for opening up his ranch to wind development about a decade ago. Pete decided that he felt it was time to move beyond fossil fuels. He also saw the economic benefits of building a wind farm, and he solicited wind developers to come to his ranch and develop a project. At the time, I don't think he had a clue how vehement the opposition was going to be. And once he pressed ahead, here's how he described what the situation was. We had TV cameras in the courtrooms. We had people pounding podiums and shaking their fists. You think abortion is a hot issue? Just try to build a wind farm in the Flint Hills. Pete really sees himself as helping wean America off of fossil fuels. Rose sees him as chasing after money. Pete, in fact, won the battle in that there is a wind farm on his property, the Elk River Wind Farm, but Rose won the war. Governor Sam Brownback last year declared through executive order the creation of a tall grass heartland, and that tall grass heartland, covering about 11,000 square miles, is now off bounds to future wind development. To be sure, wind power does have its downsides beyond the visuals, and we can debate the visuals. I happen to think wind turbines are beautiful. Other people think they're ugly. Leaving that aside, there are some real environmental issues pertaining to wind power. And some of those issues really derived from the wind farms that were built in a very hurried, somewhat slapdash manner in the 1980s. Wind farms that looked like this one. This wind farm is just west of Palm Springs, California. And as you can see, the wind turbines are spaced very close to one another. Their blades sweep close to the ground, and though you can't tell from this picture, they spin at a very rapid rate of 30 to 40 revolutions per minute. Wind farms like this have been responsible for a disturbing number of birds being killed, and in particular, raptors or predatory birds, and in particular, golden eagles at a few of these wind farms. And a serious problem. Fortunately, today, wind farms look very different and function very differently. This, again, is Pete Farrell's wind farm on his ranch. And as you can see, the turbines stand much taller. They're much more generously spaced across the landscape. And they actually spin at a much slower speed of about 16 revolutions per minute. So birds can navigate their way between them, can actually see the turbine blades spinning. It doesn't mean that there's no risk to bird life. There is a risk to bird life. But smart sighting of wind turbines so that they're not sighted in areas where there are endangered species, so that they're not sighted in major migratory flyways, can make a big difference. Some wind farms are, in fact, sited in migratory areas, and there is a wind farm in Bulgaria that has used an interesting combination of human smarts and modern technology to minimize any damage to bird life. There's an on-site ornithologist at this wind farm day in and day out, and that ornithologist uses radar as well as visual sightings to determine when the wind farm should be shut down. And late in 2010, a flock of 30,000 white storks was passing through the area. He ordered the wind farm shut down 37 times in 2 days, and not a single white stork was harmed. So there are ways to get smarter about how we manage this technology. There are issues with bats that I won't take the time to talk about right now, but there are also smart ways to minimize the damage to bats from wind farms. A further challenge facing wind power is, well, you can generate it in Wyoming or South Dakota or North Dakota, but how do you get it to the population centers where it's really most needed? And the answer is you have to build transmission lines. And before people get too alarmed about that, I just want to remind you that there are now 2.4 million miles of gas pipelines in America, and we're going to see that number increase very substantially with the fracking boom that is now upon us. So, yes, transmission is a challenge facing wind power as we begin to develop it on a very substantial scale, but there is a market for this technology. Renewable portfolio standards in places like California. By the way, California has the most ambitious standard in the country, which is that it will be 33% reliant on renewable resources for its power supply by 2020, which is a pretty remarkable goal. And that is a challenge. The other challenge is, I want to tell you about this guy before I get to the other challenge. This is Bob Whitten, and he is a Wyoming rancher, and he has created an association. It's called the Renewable Energy Alliance of Landowners, or REAL. And this Alliance of Landowners has assembled parcels of land totaling about 800,000 acres, and they are marketing this acreage to various wind developers, and the challenge will be, again, to get the wind from those ranches down into the Las Vegas area and on into Southern California. But it's an interesting approach to be proactive in going after wind developers rather than wind developers actually coming to individual landowners and cutting separate deals with the landowners. He's very proud of the fact that he and his fellow REAL members are taking the challenge upon themselves to line up wind development that can benefit them as well as our renewable energy economy. The other important piece of the puzzle in terms of transmission and how you manage wind power is how do you deal with the fact that the wind doesn't always blow? Same thing with solar energy. You have abundant energy during the daytime, you have none at night. With wind, the pattern is somewhat different, but you've got to be able to manage a smart grid. You can't simply rely upon the kind of dumb grid that we've been using for the past several decades where you turn on a coal plant or turn on a nuclear plant and it operates until the day you decommission it. Wind power is variable. Well, there's a good news side of the story, and that is if we were to develop a network of millions of electric vehicles, we would be providing a storage resource for wind-generated power. Most of us don't drive more, if we drive at all, and in Seattle I'm happy to see that it looks like a lot of people actually don't drive, but those of us who do drive probably don't drive more than a half hour, an hour, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours a day. So that means that there are 22 hours a day where you could be plugging in your vehicle and having your local utility determine when to charge that vehicle, and in fact, when to very carefully draw power off of that vehicle to even out the bumps in the wind-generated power. This is not pie in the sky. This can happen. We're developing a smart grid on various levels. Various appliances can be managed in this way. I met with the head of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and he talked about a refrigerator as not a single unit, but as multiple units. There's a defrost unit, there's a cooling unit, there's an ice maker, there are other units, I've forgotten which they are. And he said, basically, you don't care when each of those different units is operating. What you want is to know that your beer is going to be cold when you want it and that you got ice. And the same thing with a car. As long as you can get in the car in the morning and start it up and go to work, do whatever you need to do, it can provide a wonderfully flexible battery resource that can get us off of foreign oil, because this is the linkage to energy independence. Often people think, well, you're talking about oil and you're talking about wind power. I don't get it, because we don't generate that much power from oil these days. Well, if we were to switch over a substantial portion of our car fleet to electricity, then we would be serving that purpose of getting us off of foreign oil, at least to a substantial degree, while creating the kind of storage resource that could really benefit a renewable energy economy. When we think about wind power, we can't think about it in a vacuum. I often say wind power isn't clean energy, it's cleaner energy. Every energy production technology creates some environmental harm. So the question is, what is the lesser evil and what is the greater evil. And what wind power will allow us to do is move away from our dependence upon more harmful forms of energy production, electricity production, one of those obviously being nuclear. I had a professor in graduate school who taught me statistics, and I don't remember much about the course, but I do remember his mantra, which was, rare events do happen. And we've seen, unfortunately, with the Fukushima disaster, with the Chernobyl disaster, that these kinds of rare events actually do happen, and they cause havoc to hundreds of thousands of people. They create devastated landscapes for decades. And in addition, nuclear power is a technology that does not have all the pieces in place yet. The other day, I was trying to find the Yucca Mountain Reserve in Nevada. It's a hidden reserve down a long, dusty road. There is no acceptable long-term means of nuclear waste storage and disposal today. And if you read the news about what is happening in Iran, the slippery slope between civilian uses of nuclear power and weapons production is a very precarious one and may well lead us into the next major regional war in the Middle East. Wind power also lets us move off of coal. To get coal, you create mines like this, open pit mines in the west or mountaintop removal mines in the east. Terrible damage to the environment. But beyond the damage caused by mining, the burning of coal obviously creates huge problems for human health and even huger problems for the global environment in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions that are going to compromise our children's and our grandchildren's livelihoods and well-being. So wind power is not a panacea, but it is a very promising technology. It's a technology that is known today. We've worked out a lot of the kinks in the technology. And what we need is really the political will to move it forward on a scale that can really help us create a more sustainable energy future. That's what I'd like to say.
Philip Warburg, the author of Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 4th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, working to stem pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by offering tips and tools such as how to dispose of hazardous materials, prevent spills, and stencil storm drains. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish. 859 949 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Born into Hollywood royalty, Liza Minnelli has made her own name on the stage and screen. Her role in the 1972 film version of the Broadway musical Cabaret made her an international sensation and won her the Academy Award for Best Actress. Recently, she's made inroads into TV's Arrested Development and recorded with alternative rockers My Chemical Romance.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.